Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This is Jay Richards, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and professor at the Catholic University of America. And I am joined by astronomer and astrobiologist Guillermo Gonzalez. Guillermo is an author of literally dozens of academic articles in astronomy and astrobiology. He's the co-author of a textbook on observational astronomy and the co-author with yours truly of the book, The Privileged Planet. Guillermo, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's talk about this recent announcement of this extrasolar planet, so-called the planet K2-18b, not an especially memorable name, but there was a number of major news stories, including pieces describing this, as we've heard before, as a, quote, potentially habitable planet. And I want to talk first a little bit about that, but then I want to talk about this interesting piece published at UNDARC by the BBC science correspondent Palab Ghosh, where he talks about the dangers of hype of stories like this. So first, let's talk a little bit about this planet, K2-18b. How far out is it? What are the details?
Sure. First of all, the name K2 actually is short for Kepler, then 2, meaning it's on its post-primary mission, which it finished its primary mission of 4 years, and it went on to observe stars all over the whole sky.
That's the Kepler telescope,
that's right. Kepler spacecraft. Yeah. And was a spectacularly successful mission, literally finding thousands of extrasolar planets. And it completed its mission in October of last year, 2018. So K2-18 means it's the 18th exoplanet found with Kepler in this post-primary mission. And then the B is just meaning that it's not the star, but the planet going around the star. The star is a red dwarf in the constellation Leo. And it's about 124 light years away. So what's interesting about this planet is that it's located within the so-called circumstellar habitable zone of its host star. And all that means is if you took the Earth and put it at that location around that star, it would probably have liquid water on the surface.
Okay.
The thing is, this planet is not an Earth twin. In fact, far from it. It's got a minimum mass of 8.6 times the mass of the Earth. So it's almost, you could say, about 9 times the mass of the Earth.
Wow.
So it's basically similar to Neptune.
Okay, so nowhere near as similar, at least in mass, to Venus or Mars.
That's right. It's almost certainly not a terrestrial planet, at least a terrestrial planet with a thin atmosphere. It's almost certainly dominated by hydrogen and helium, so it's much more likely to be more like Neptune or even Saturn in our solar system with a thick atmosphere, which pretty much precludes it from having life. But what's interesting about this is that they found liquid water in its atmosphere.
Okay, so is that the, because I know the story, most people, if they've heard of this, will have just heard of this kind of news stories about it, but there was this, apparently this single study that discovered this water in the atmosphere. Is that what the big news was?
That's what it is, because there are several exoplanet candidates within the circumstellar habitable zones of their host stars. So that by itself is no longer news. So the news part of it is that the first time they found water in the atmosphere of a planet that's located within the circumstellar habitable zone of its host star. And, of course, some science writers really jumped on this and excitedly thought, ooh, liquid water within the habitable zone, therefore life.
Boom, that's all you need.
Yeah.
And well, that is, admittedly, those are two things you need. You need water and you need the planet to be in the right location so you can have liquid water. So far, so good. But there's a chorus of critics. And this is what Palab Ghosh in his piece at UNDARC. And again, he's a BBC correspondent. So if anything, probably would be likely to join in the hype, actually raised some problems. I mean, what were the chorus of critics? What were they complaining about?
Well, that people were saying this is potentially habitable or habitable, jumping the gun there to being too excited about having possibly life when it's in fact nothing like the Earth. It's, you know, as you know, there are many requirements for life and especially complex life on a planet. Being within the circumstellar habitable zone and having liquid water are just two of them. And there are many more. So planet size is another one, and thickness of the atmosphere, composition of the atmosphere, and then many more. So this is definitely not a habitable planet. Probably has a strong greenhouse effect, so it probably has a very high surface temperature. It's probably more like Venus, even if it even has a surface. We don't know that it has a solid surface. Probably doesn't. If it's like Neptune, it probably does not have a solid surface.
So what's funny is that Ghosh actually says, well, the problem is that news outlets are crying wolf, which I don't quite understand what he means, but I think he means that, look, if people get used to every time there is an extrasolar planet with some interesting feature, all the science journalists hype the thing and say it's potentially habitable, maybe people will get jaded. Is that what he's worried about?
Yeah, that's one of the things he's worried about. That's right. And I should add also that just the fact that it has liquid water, yes, it's interesting, very interesting when it comes to life, habitability, but liquid water is really not that rare. It's located on many bodies within our solar system. In fact, NASA likes to use the maxim, follow the water, when it's searching for life in our solar system and now outside the solar system. But it's just one of the many requirements for life, as I mentioned before.
Well, and so what's funny is that, I mean, I guess I wonder that the fact that Ghosh is complaining about this directly is in some ways the fact that he's aware of how long this has been going on. I mean, we've been now discovering extrasolar planets for years. And you and I remember early on, right, about, you know, when the Privileged Planet came out, when these were maybe less common, these discoveries, almost every planet that was discovered was supposedly Earth-like.
That's right. I mean,
and so it's like, well, it's a planet and it's around a star. So, of course, every planet's going to be Earth-like on some feature. The question is whether it's got anything like the kind of suite of characteristics that you'd actually need, right?
That's right. And this is just another example of some journalists getting a little bit too excited. And I should give the author the compliment for catching himself and taking back a little bit of his excitement and what he had written about this story and apologizing to some degree.
That's right, because I'm not even mentioning that. He had written, in fact, a previous story, you know, sort of joining in the hype, and maybe he himself is sort of tired of this. And so then he kind of uses this example that is the hype over the discovery of K2-18b, advertising it as this potentially habitable planet as a kind of case study in what science journalists in general ought to watch for. And so he talks about some of the things that science journalists actually ought to do. And kind of really the first thing seems commonsensical, but that science journalists should always talk to critics. So especially when you're dealing with a single scientific study, even if it's really exciting, yeah, you try to report it fairly. But he says also try to find scientific critics. I mean, does that make sense to me? It makes sense to you?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. In other words, you know, I mean, I'll say this only slightly tongue-in-cheek, but he's saying in a sense, look, teach the controversy or at least report the controversy. Don't pretend that this is all sewn up and just, you know, use science journalism essentially as a press release for the scientist that happens to have issued the paper. Because, of course, for most people, like most people, Guillermo, I'm sorry, most people are not reading the Astrophysical Journal.
Oh, really?
And Icarus. No, they're not. They're not reading it before they go to bed, or they're reading it so that they can go to bed. You know, we're getting this stuff. And look, I read PubMed and check, you know, AstroPH, but most people, including me, we get most of our information about what's happening in scientific research from science journalists, from headlines and stories that we see in Scientific American or the New York Times. And that's the case here. And so we really rely on these science journalists who mediate this, don't we, to try to present the evidence fairly, which almost always is going to require, okay, describe what this one scientist is claiming and then find his best critic and describe that as well. I mean, this just really seems like not only the way journalism should be done, but the way science should be done.
Yeah, that would be the case in an ideal world. Unfortunately, I don't think we live in an ideal world in this instance.
No, we don't. And what's funny is there's a sort of interesting tell because in this piece, he says, okay, well, we need to present this kind of balanced view, which means finding credible critics. But he says, of course, that doesn't mean that every viewpoint is equally valid or that you have to somehow describe every potential perspective on a scientific question. And so he says, of course, you know, when you're talking about climate science, for instance, which is obviously very controversial, he says very often you'll get these interested parties and you'll get climate deniers, he says.
That's an extremely offensive term, yes.
It is, because, I mean, the reality is there aren't any climate deniers. I've never actually met anyone that denies the existence of climate.
Neither have I.
No, and presumably he's talking about people who, I don't know, maybe don't accept the UN's take or Greta Thunberg's take on the climate catastrophe. I assume that's what he's talking about, right?
Yeah. Yeah, sounds like it.
I mean, that's, yeah. And the people, of course, that don't follow the climate controversy might not know there's actually multiple issues involved, as we've talked about for years. I mean, there's this question about whether the climate's really the average global temperature is going up. That is a global warming? And then what kind of climate change that's causing? Are we causing it? Is human activity mainly causing it? Is it a bad thing? And would any particular policies that people propose actually make any difference? I mean, those are separate issues, and you might have questions about any of those. That doesn't mean you deny the climate. It obviously doesn't mean you deny that climate changes. None of that's sort of it's at stake. But what's funny about this is how even in an article by, I think, a well-meaning BBC science correspondent about the importance of science journalists reporting legitimate range of opinions, he immediately turns to a subject in which he himself seems not to show that same attitude, yep. Namely climate science.
It's highly ironic, yes.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's very odd. And this is really, honestly, the danger in trusting science journalists to do your work for you, is that even when they want to present a balanced view, they tend to be blind to their own biases, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. You can see it here, yeah, with that offensive statement.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's sort of the dilemma, because then if you get into something controversial like Darwinian evolution or intelligent design, presumably journalists like Ghosh, I'm assuming, would place that controversy as a kind of non-controversy, right?
Right.
Oh, those are only crazy people and cranks that think that. So we don't need to be balanced on those issues.
Yeah. The science writers are setting themselves up as the gatekeepers, and they're deciding who comes in to the round table of discussion and who gets left out.
That's right. And so, I mean, what would the ideal be? Like, if you could say Guillermo Gonzalez's ideal of how science writers actually ought to deal with these things, I mean, how do you think, if they were going to do it, what would the ideal be?
That's a good question. The ideal would be certainly present the mainstream opinion and the consensus, and then carefully look through the journals and see what other points of view have been presented. Even though it may not be the majority view, it may be a small minority view. If there have been some defenders of that position in science journals, in peer-reviewed papers, then they deserve to be heard, even if there's only a few of them. Because after all, that's how scientific revolutions occur, with one or a few individuals coming up with a new idea that overturns a paradigm.
Yeah, I mean, that's the danger, is that if, you know, if the science journalists themselves decide who gets to be in the debate, they're almost always going to miss the revolutionaries that actually overturn the reigning ideas.
Right.
You know, that's a sort of irony. I mean, I know I tell students all the time, look, when you're making an argument, whatever your view is in a paper, you want to find the best arguments against your position, not the worst representatives, not the caricatures and the straw man. Find the very best arguments against it. And maybe that's too high of a standard, that, you know, science journalists can't all be stellar philosophers and able to kind of analyze arguments. But at the very least, that could be an ideal. Okay, what's the best argument and the most articulate critic of this view out there? And then try to find them and get a quote from them. I can't imagine that there's would be a danger in that. And it could certainly improve the way in which science journalism is done, would it not?
Absolutely. And in the case of the climate science debate, you know, one doesn't have to look very far. Just look at the people who've testified before Congress, right, on both sides of the issue.
Oh, yeah.
So their names are out there, the names of the experts on both sides of the issue. The side that says that, no, we're probably not causing catastrophic climate change, and the side that says that, yes, we're definitely responsible for climate change that will become catastrophic.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, people like Richard Lindzen, at MIT.
Yeah.
I mean, this is no slouch. He's a professor of meteorology at MIT, and he's deeply skeptical that we're causing catastrophic climate change. So the idea that this is all just sort of fringes is, I think, laughable.
And Roy Spencer at Huntsville, Alabama, also.
That's right. The other irony, of course, and many listeners will know this, is that the BBC is entirely in the tank for the catastrophist interpretation of the climate issue. I mean, it's just really bad. In fact, I think they've sort of on the record saying they're not planning on presenting the issue in a balanced way anymore.
Yeah, it's sad.
No, it really is. Well, I mean, and these issues are related, are they not? I mean, this question about the habitability of planets and what it takes to build a habitable planet and the debate of climate change, these aren't two totally separate issues. They're actually related.
They're related at the level of science, for one thing, talking about the climate of the Earth and how sensitive it is to changes in the climate on other planets and whether they can support life. But also that there are big questions that have profound implications for the future of mankind on Earth with climate change, and also with the possibility of discovering life on other worlds, which of course is one of the biggest questions that scientists ask. So there's a lot riding on both of them, and people can unfortunately get their opinions into it in a way that's not justified because they're motivated to have an input on these big questions.
They are. And I mean, to be fair to science journalists, I mean, there is, I know as someone who, you know, runs an online news and commentary site that, you know, sensational statements always sell, saying, oh, another planet that has a couple of interesting features, that's not going to get click-throughs, but saying it's potentially habitable, that's going to get a lot of interest. And that's just kind of the basic economic realities of science journalism. But in some ways, I think that really underscores the importance of sites like Discovery Institute's Evolution News and Views. And this podcast, ID the Future, because we're not coming at this based on the kind of economics of click-throughs. We're genuinely interested in these issues and in the truth of the matter. And honestly, I hope that we do a good job, even when we're critical of folks on the other sides of issues, of presenting their issues accurately. And in this case, of course, we're highly attuned to the hype surrounding the search for extrasolar planets and especially habitable planets, because we, of course, wrote a book on this, The Privileged Planet. And maybe this is a time to tease the second edition of Privileged Planet. The publisher let us know a few months ago that the hardcover edition is almost completely sold out. And so they're issuing a new edition of Privileged Planet. I don't know the exact date, and I don't think you do either. Have you gotten any information? So I don't know. So in any case, listeners who are interested maybe in a less expensive version of The Privileged Planet, there is a paperback edition coming out here in a few months. And we talk not just about what it takes to build a habitable planet, not just about what it takes to have a place in the universe where you can do science, but we actually talk a little bit about this climate issue in there as well. So, well, this is a great discussion, Guillermo. It's always fun to be able to talk to you about this. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And if you enjoy ID the Future in this conversation, I'd like to ask you, just take a few minutes to go to the podcast app of your choice and give ID the Future a 5-star rating. Those ratings really help boost our podcast visibility and interest and audience. This is Jay Richards. Thanks so much for joining us.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.